Welcome to Non-Consensus Investing. I'm Ram Ahluwalia, your host and CIO at Lumida Wealth, where we specialize in the craft of alternative investments. At Lumida, we help guide clients through the intricacies of managing wealth so they don't have to shoulder the burden alone. Through this podcast, we draw back the curtain to reveal the strategies employed by the best in the business for their clients so that you too can invest beyond the ordinary.
All right, welcome to the next episode of Lumida Non-Consensus Investing. I am thrilled to have a very special guest and friend, Andrew Keys. This title of this show is called Diamond Hands, the Ethereum Machine with Andrew Keys. Andrew's got an incredible story. I'm thrilled and honored to have him share that story with us today. And Andrew is the chairman of the Ethereum Machine, which is publicly traded. He is the largest contributor to any publicly traded Ethereum DAT, and not just by a little bit, but by an order of magnitude. So we're going to get into that. Andrew also comes from a traditional finance background like me. He saw the opportunity around Ethereum. Andrew and I, of all places, we met in China, right? We met in China in 2015. We were on a bus with maybe a dozen other fintech entrepreneurs. We got to know each other there, struck up a friendship there. And Andrew was telling the story of Ethereum in 2015. What I should have done is just sold my company there and say, Andrew, I work for you. Let's go do this thing. Let's go.
Should have just bought Ether, sold your company and bought Ether. That would have been much better.
Exactly. What was Ethereum priced at back then?
A dollar.
It was a dollar, right?
So quick and interesting story. The first time Ether crossed $1 was because I put a permissioned version of the Java client on top of Microsoft Azure. So banks and Fortune 500s could play with the concept of tokenizing any asset. And we named it the cliche marketing blockchain as a service and had Paul Vigna from the Wall Street Journal write a 100-word article. And on that article being released, Ether crossed the dollar in October of 2015.
So that was limit up Ether to a dollar based on this article.
To $1. We were going places then.
We're going to talk about quite a few topics today. One is your story, which is as much a story about Ethereum, because you are the person who introduced the concept to Wall Street. So we'll get into that. We'll get into where we are in the digital asset treasury cycle and the differentiation. Ethereum Machine is out there. BitMiner's out there. BitMiner put out a press release the other day. We'll talk about that too. And also just your experience, like just diamond handing this thing through massive drawdowns and riding Ethereum from a dollar to where it is today, which is a 4,000x return. So a lot to get into. First off, why don't you introduce Ethereum Machine just to orient everyone? Like, what is Ethereum Machine?
Sure. So the Ether Machine is a institutionally focused public vehicle with just shy of $3 billion of committed capital and about 500,000 Ether and some dollars that is not a buy and hold digital asset treasury. We are an operating business that gives public market exposure to Ether and Ether generated yield. And the way we got here was in a prior life, I had built an institutional commodity pool operator and commodity trading advisor under the acronym of DARMA, which is Digital Asset Risk Management Advisors, and had been staking tens of thousands of Ether validators. So there's 32 Ether per validator. So institutional scale from inception of Ethereum's proof of stake consensus transition from proof of work. And one of the large ETFs came up to me and said, will you be my market maker? Because when ETFs enable staking, the ETFs have a 24-hour redemption requirement. And so right now in the United States, the exchange-traded funds in America do not enable staking. So simply put, that's like having a stock that generates a dividend, but owning the stock and not getting the dividend. But that's more of a relic of the Gensler era. And we believe those headwinds will be tailwinds soon enough. and they will enable staking in the ETFs. But the issue, and you can look at Canada or Europe as a proxy, is Canadian and European ETPs that do enable staking stake at what I call 50% capacity, meaning if you have $1 billion, they're staking only 500 million and they're generating what I would call the floor yield on that 500 million. So really on $1 billion, the floor yield right now is 3%. So they're really generating 1.5%. And I thought that was inefficient, and we'd be able to generate the full staking yield because this is an operating business rather than an ETP that has 24-hour redemption requirements. And then furthermore, we could do other Ether-denominated yield-generating activities. So one place that we could add is through a concept of restaking, where you can take Ethereum's proof-of-stake consensus mechanism and use it to secure other technologies. The leader in that space is a company called EigenLayer. And EigenLayer had $10 million invested in it at $100 million at $1 billion valuation by Andreessen Horowitz about a year ago. 2 years before that, I personally invested $2 million at a $25 million valuation. Wow. And my firm has been closest to the metal in creating user experience testing, bug bounties, and basically doing product market fit, testing the concept of restaking.
So you're up 40X on EigenLayer. Look, it's not a 4,000X Ethereum, but we'll give you a pass on that one. Yeah. Lightning strikes twice. So framing up is there was Bitcoin, and the digital asset trend for Bitcoin is MicroStrategy, MSTR. That was the first DAT. Yeah. And then you're involved in Ethereum in the very early days at $1. And you're at consensus. And now you launch Ethereum machine, and essentially it's built off this, the technology and know-how from Narma, because you were a service provider to these publicly traded funds that wanted to maximize the yield generated by the staking activities of Ethereum.
So to talk through that differentiation, we should start with Bitcoin versus Ether. So Bitcoin has a category defining winner already in MSTR. Furthermore, Bitcoin doesn't really interest me too much. On the Bitcoin blockchain, there is one asset, a Bitcoin, and there is one function, SEN. It's like a global abacus where I can send the bead to Rom on the abacus and Rom can send it back to me. Ethereum interests me because I believe Ethereum to be the next generation of the internet. And basically we can digitize any type of asset. So a stock, a bond, a derivative, an electron on a solar panel, and then we can embed those assets into digital legal agreements called smart contracts. And we can say, if X were to occur, then send the asset, else failure. And so basically, I believe that Bitcoin has the TAM of digital gold, whereas Ether has the TAM of the next generation of the internet. And if you can put a price on the total addressable market of what commerce on the internet is, I believe it to be exponentially larger. Now, furthermore, if you really understand the digital asset treasury space, it's important to understand how MicroStrategy got to where it was. And basically, the benefit of having a public vehicle versus my commodity pool operator, commodity trading advisor, when I had SMAs, for example, separately managed accounts, is in the public vehicle, we're able to use the public capital markets and we can issue equity or we can issue debt, simply put. And MicroStrategy didn't get from single digit billions to a $100 billion vehicle by issuing equity. And depending upon how you issue equity, that could even be dilutive to your shareholders. And what made MicroStrategy grow from single digit billions to centibillions is what is called a convertible bond. And to understand how these convertible bonds work, you're essentially selling volatility to a hedge fund that wants to acquire volatility. And then the proceeds of that sale via convertible bond is used for cash to acquire the digital asset for the shareholders that are looking for exposure to the underlying specific digital asset. In MicroStrategy's case, that was Bitcoin. The good news is that with Ether, it is double the volatility of Bitcoin. And unlike Bitcoin that doesn't generate yield, Ethereum can generate yield. So if there are coupons, like in a preferred share, we have a much better way to satisfy yield payments. So basically, it's double the ball with the ability to generate yield. So basically, this is a better asset for this type of public vehicle.
Right. So MicroStrategy built a capital markets machine around itself. And to your point, what they did is they were selling convertible bonds and they packaged an equity-like instrument that was marketable to fixed income investors. If you're a fixed income investor, the world is very dry, plain vanilla. There's not much to do. But in a convertible bond format, fixed income investors had the ability to get an exposure to the growth in Bitcoin. It's very clever, brilliant move that Michael Saylor did. And obviously he's expanded that and it's created an array of different products participating. And that was the first digital asset treasury. Over the last 3 months, we've seen a proliferation of them. I think what separates Ethereum machine versus others is like your personal commitment to it. Like how much capital did you contribute to the Ethereum machine versus the other dats?
So I contributed 150,000 Ether. Present day, that's about $750 million. And I think the second largest contributor was $40 million.
That'd be like Joe Lubin?
At Aspen.
At Aspen,
yes,
right.
Yes. And I think it's important to understand when we talk about differentiation, we explained Bitcoin versus Ether. We talked about the ETF as a way to express one's views for Ether. I look at it as an inefficient way because you're only availing yourself to part of the yield that's being generated versus a public vehicle like this, where we can generate the full Ether yield and also have restaking and potential participation in DeFi. So we should be able to, if you look at this as a perpetual bond, and we have double the yield of the ETF, it should be double the value. And that's where I think you can start to justify an MNAV greater than one in perpetuity.
A market cap divided by net asset value ratio. Go ahead.
And if you have a multiple to the net asset value within the vehicle.
Right. Now, Bitminer is Tom Lee's vehicle. And how did Tom Lee contribute Ethereum to that?
I believe, as understood, it was very little. It's a little unclear to me if it was none or very little, but I'm sure it could be found.
I'll ask my trusty analyst here, Brock, in the background.
There you go.
Got it. So the main differentiation is like, number one, you're involved personally with your balance. You have an alignment with your investors. That one. And then two, you're generating twice the yield because of the mechanics of how you stay built from your experience from Dharma. So there's an interesting press release that came out actually.
And if I may, Ron, I think there's another point, which is number three, which I think is a really core differentiator. There are two ways to go about this. And we've gone what I would call the patient route. One way is you can pick your poison and do a reverse takeover of a dying company on New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ. And that's basically what I would call it, the reverse takeover of a shell company. And I had three conversations just to give you an idea of what those looked like. One was a biotech company and the drug didn't make it through clinical trials and the company was going bankrupt and they had a vehicle that I could have taken over. But due to how public vehicles work, you can't remove the C-suite of a company immediately on day zero. They have to basically stay on board. And due to change of control provisions, you can't just remove everybody because you're going in a different direction. And so this company's CEO literally wrote me an email and he spelled Ethereum wrong. He didn't even know how to spell Ethereum, but wanted $5 million a year to stay on board because he viewed the asset as this shell company that had already gone through, let's call it, public SEC processes. Another one was a Bitcoin mining firm that had a $10 million a year data center lease because you need hardware, real estate, electricity for proof of work mining, and that the business was upside down. And they were in year four, and they wanted me to take on those contingent liabilities, year 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There are other ones that basically wanted a percentage of capital that was raised for lawsuits. That basically, because you're inheriting some business that has a statute of limitations of 4 years. So basically, you don't know the skeletons in the closet of the last 4 years. So basically, that's the shell company. You get out the door quicker, but basically, there's these two businesses that are being operated, the old one, the new one. There may be contingent lawsuits based on statute of limitations, and there's all sorts of liabilities. And I just, if I was going to contribute my own capital, I wasn't going to put that money at risk.
Right, because people go after the honeypot, right? They see a lot of value in the asset. Then lawsuits, even if they are groundless, you get like the ambulance chasing equivalent in the stock market. There are specialized law firms. The only thing they do is they litigate. The price 100%. Drop, they litigate.
100%.
So you wanted to be removed from all of that.
So basically what I did was I created a de novo entity, brand new, no pre-existing operating business. We anchored it with Ether, and that is going through a business combination agreement with a special purpose acquisition company, or a SPAC. And basically, to do that, we also had to raise capital. So we did the largest common equity raise, which was $1.5 billion or $1.6 billion. And then we did a subsequent follow-on round, which was another $700 million. And so we've got about $2.5 billion, give or take the price of Ether.
And you participated in that through an in-kind contribution of Ether?
Yes, correct.
And you were in both of those, or the first one? Or
no, I was in the first one.
You were in the first one. Got it.
And we also went through a Big Four audit, which I think is important. So we're the only treasury vehicle since MicroStrategy to go through a Big Four audit. And that's important because if you understand how this works, what really drove MicroStrategy's growth was the ability to issue convertible bonds and preferred shares. And basically, none of the banks will underwrite convertible bonds or preferred shares unless you have a Big Four audit.
Makes
sense. So basically, we didn't optimize to be first at the gate, where a bunch of vehicles have been able to acquire maybe more Ether sooner. But what we think is that we did that to be prudent with our own capital, because I think that this is a different type of vehicle. We have thematic investors that are long-term Ether holders. So we believe that this will be a better cap table versus the fair weather vehicles that are shells. And we believe that once this, and we just announced our confidential S-4 filing, and once this is through the blessing of the SEC, we should be best suited for those credit instruments like convertible bonds and preferred shares going
forward. We're taking an institutional approach, kind of like the big boy approach with audit, belts and suspenders, the right internal controls, so that you can build trust with capital markets, so that the investment bank can say, yes, I'll engage with you, I'll help you with your debt offerings.
Yeah, exactly, Ram. And then I would just add to that, if you go through these shells, a lot of them are much smaller. You've never heard of the investment bank. You never heard of the law firm. You never heard of the auditor. We went out with Citibank. Scadden's our legal and our auditor. Point, this is the institutional.
That makes a lot of sense to me. So BitMiner posted this press release yesterday. It's interesting. So let's see what our Grok analyst had to say. Actually, I asked Grok contributions to these. This can't be right. There's no way Tom Lee has 2.4 million Ethereum holdings. If that's true.
Vehicle, BitMiner has 2.4 million Ether in it. I don't think that he contributed.
Yeah, Grok got that a bit off. The analyst still needs some work there. So BitMiner posted this press release. I'll share my screen here. I think this gets to how important the details matter and how much the docs matter, right? For those that are listening, they read it. So the article says, BitMiner Immersion announces ETH holdings exceeding 2% of network with ETH. This came out yesterday at 7 a.m. Eastern time. And so it leads with a strong headline. Now, what I thought that was quite interesting about this is that this press release coincided with an SEC filing And here are some of the highlights of that SEC filing. Bitminer, it looks like they issued some shares at a premium of 14%, $70 versus the $61 close price in Bitminer. Let me pull up just Bitminer here quick on the screen. I'll share this too. Moment here. But what it shows is that at the same time, there was also an issuance of warrants, right? And the way the warrants work is if the stock trades above 87.50, it's at 55 now, then the holders can exercise without laying out cash. That's another way of saying new shares, but without raising capital. That's dilutive. So the premium that you see is actually, technically it's a discount. It's just packaged in press release language to make it look like it came from strength. When in fact, to motivate and attract the buyer, they had to issue warrants. So in a way, you attract capital today, you get a bid today, but you're giving up dilution in the future. It's financial engineering. How does that land for you? Does that read make sense?
So I think that's accurate. I personally wouldn't have agreed to an instrument like this because I have skin in my game. And my sole purpose of this vehicle is increasing my Ether concentration per share. And that strikes me as dilutive. And furthermore, I think the other piece that I noticed is that I think this reiterates another piece is that I think that if they could, they would have done a convertible bond or a preferred share. And this is double financial engineering because they had to do this kind of premium and warrant because back to shell company versus SPAC, another consideration there.
It's like a hand waving. I saw The Prestige this week in that wonderful Christopher Nolan film. It's about a distraction. Take a look at these press releases. Came out on the same day. This one was at 7 a.m. Headline, ETH holdings exceed 2% of Ethereum network. Very bullish. By the way, Mark, the pre-market opens at 7 a.m. So what happens is, I don't know what the price happened yesterday, but I'm pretty sure it went up. And then at 7:15, there's another headline, and it says that Bitminer announces pricing of $365 million registered direct offering at $70 per share. This is the warrants.
Forgets the warrants.
The common shares at a 14 premium to the closing price. And then there's okay, it's backed by Premier Seven investors, including Kathy Wood, the
common.
And then if you look at the docs and there's warrants, then our future dilution. This is like the Wall Street machine in action.
Play silly games, you win silly prizes.
Right. So press release one, bullet. Press release two, we're diluting. Fine print in the SEC filing. Years old. It's a warrant. And these dots come, it's like the fact.
But I don't think retail got that. And what retail got is sold it at 14% higher than what you could have bought it at.
Yes, exactly. It's a,
which is a shame, which is a problem, which is why play silly games, you win silly prizes. And if somebody's trying to do this properly, that's going to reflect poorly on the industry.
And look, you look at the incentives drive outcomes. So,
Charlie Munger.
Exactly. So I give Tom Lee credit for a number of things. One of them is certainly highlighting Ethereum. I wrote this back in June. I know you shared this thesis too, that Ethereum is a link to the rise of stablecoins. And then a few weeks later, Bitminer comes out. Tom Lee is compensated based on the value of the options he has in the business. So the motivation there is make the price go higher, but doesn't have the same skin in the game that you do. If you dilute through a warrants offering to issue a press release that looks exciting, you'll be trading a short-term pump for long-term dilution. And so you wouldn't necessarily want to do that because you're in the boat. We're all in the same boat. So anyway, I thought that was a worthwhile exercise just to inform and educate how these work. There's a reason why these filings exist at the SEC. And you really do have to go through the fine print. I've seen digital asset treasuries, by the way, where the management team is authorized to fly in a private jet and it's paid for by the DAP. That makes no sense to me. This is a decentralized technology. You can be in a Zoom call.
100% agreed.
Why are you paying for the management team to expense a private jet on your dime?
Agreed.
And let's talk a bit now to shifting gear. So I think we start by talking about, here's Bitcoin. You said it's your ability to send money. Then Ethereum shows up on the scene. You're part of that story. It's a Turing complete decentralized world computer on which you can move, exchange value, build apps and have trustless agreements between smart contracts and people in the real world or smart contracts and AI agents or other smart contracts. Let's talk about that journey. I think your personal journey here
is sure.
incredibly fascinating because you had massive drawdowns along the way. I remember some of those hearts and prayers from my friend Andrew Keys here. It went up to it was like 1,200. I want to say like during the 2017 top, then Vitalik says, do we deserve it? Top of the market goes down to 60. Walk us through that journey. Sure. What were the moments where you felt your conviction was tested?
Sure. I would say before, let's call it Ether owner, I think it's better to take it a few steps before that. Educated, econ, computer science, worked at UBS Investment Bank, did some capital market stuff. I couldn't handle the bureaucracy of big banks, did a few startups. The one prior to my blockchain experience, I built a revenue cycle management company. And simply put, when you went to the doctor's office, you would hand your insurance card to the person at the front desk. That information would get sent through my software to Chennai, India, where the billers would fight with Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Cigna, who were also in Chennai, India. And then eventually Dr. Jones would get paid and we would earn a percentage of that revenue for processing those insurance claims. And simply put, in a very specific sector, let's just call it healthcare, I learned all of the problems with legacy payment systems and databases. And that was basically at the same time Bitcoin happened. And like Ram, and he should have sold his business and just bought Ether. I should have sold my business then and bought Bitcoin. But I was stubborn. And my position was, having built a payments company, I know that it was that payments are more complicated than I just send Ram value. I didn't get off zero until I saw the addition of arbitrarily complex logic, meaning if X happens, then send payment, else failure. Simply put, that is what Ron mentioned as the Turing complete nature of a smart contract. And so I went to the first ever Ethereum meetup, literally meetup.com, like a nerd in Manhattan in 2014. It was being hosted by Aaron Wright, who is a professor of computer science and law at Cardozo Law School. There were a bunch of fellow nerds in the room, and Aaron was explaining the potential of how this stuff works. And Joe Lubin was there as one of the founders of the Ethereum Foundation, and it blew my mind because I had enough understanding of software architecture. I had enough kind of legacy experience of how payment systems work. And I had enough kind of understanding and appreciation of Bitcoin as a peer-to-peer distributed ledger. But due to UTXO, you could only just send Alice could only send Bob value. And that was the only function. And that was just not compelling to me. But basically, that was my day zero in this. And I remember leaving being like, this could be the ability to have the internet where we could really move any asset and embed any asset into any type of agreement. And that was enough to percolate my brain.
Right. So Ether is unspent transaction output. This is core to the Bitcoin model. And Turing complete, I mean, this comes from Alan Turing, the father of computer science and computation. A Turing complete computer is able to compute. It can compute anything a computer computes. Now, what a computer's computer is a different question.
It's what you can dream, right? That's the cool thing about the internet, right? And 85% of the internet goes to zero. The other 15% changes the world. And I figured it would be a similar arc there. And Joe was considering creating, in his words, was Crypto Alphabet, where Alphabet is the holding company of 100 different companies. Google is the big operator. There's 100 companies that Alphabet owns. And there wasn't a business model. There wasn't a product market fit. We were building software for platform that hadn't yet launched, for a technology that hadn't been built. And Consensus went on to create 3 of the 8 or now 12 implementations of Ethereum, one of the most used wallets in MetaMask, Akamai for blockchain, which is called Infura, and then a bunch of apps that frankly failed. Just
And MetaMask is such an incredible business, right? It generates billions and billions of revenue as software and enabling people to interact on chain. Interact on chain means send people money or transact with a smart contract or digitally sign, perform some kind of service. And Infura also, again, core infrastructure. Like the story of Consensus and Ethereum is an important story to be told. And you were a part of that. Working Joe Lubin. Now, you also played this role of really evangelizing to Wall Street and really the public at large. What did that journey look like?
So probably there were two main avenues by which I did that. One was this concept of blockchain as a service via Microsoft, where we put a permission version of Ethereum onto Azure and then basically used Microsoft's global footprint and their clientele base to tell the story of Ethereum. So everybody in the Fortune 500, from JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs to Walmart to ExxonMobil, is a Microsoft client, whether it's Microsoft Office, Microsoft Azure. And so basically we were able to use that channel. Every one of those clients, there was a button where they could play with Ethereum. And so that was much more of the technical inroad. And then there was another avenue where we created what was called the Enterprise Ethereum Alliance. And at that point in time, there was another consortia named R3 that basically started with a permission version of Ethereum on Azure. They basically
Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley got there to build a consortium to build essentially Wall Street's blockchain. Still hasn't gone anywhere, by the way.
It's gone nowhere. And basically what they started on was our blockchain as a service, PS. And basically, a quick historical lesson. One of the reasons, and there are a few reasons, in my opinion, why Ethereum is winning, and I think it's always worth noting. But one of the reasons Java won, Java right now is the most used computer language. And basically, when Java became J2EE, Java 2, the enterprise edition, was because it had standards. And what that meant is that whether you were in Mumbai, San Francisco, New York, or Paris, you had clean web APIs and clean database APIs, and you were using the same thing. And what the Enterprise Ethereum Alliance was, it took companies like Microsoft, JP Morgan, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, Exxon, Accenture, Deloitte, and basically had a standards body to basically create these types of standards. So what a permission version of Ethereum would look like, how a permissioned and a permissionless version of Ethereum could interact. Very similar to intranets and internet, the token standard. So basically these assets could go into a wallet and everyone could have the same wallet standard and a token standard and a reputation standard. So basically that's one of the core reasons I think that Ethereum has worked really well, is because we focused on creating these standards very early. Secondarily, we understand kind of other aspects of Ethereum. There's 12 implementations of Ethereum versus an example of Solana. There's one implementation of Solana. There's one implementation of Bitcoin Core. And so basically 12 different software languages have to form consensus every 6 seconds for this network to continue to flourish. And it's had 100% uptime over the last 10 years since its inception. And then the last piece that I think is worth noting is just the fact that liquidity begets liquidity. And there's about $250 billion of what we call high quality liquid assets. And that's a technical definition.
It takes a regulator to own a minimum amount of that.
And so of HQLA, 90%+ of HQLA that are on blockchain settle to Ethereum. 9% settles on the next one, and about 2% settles on all the rest.
So it would be like stable coins fully backed by treasuries. That'd be an example.
Yep.
Another would be like Biddle, BlockRock's treasury market fund on chain, Ondo, tokenized treasuries. So these are examples where you're calling HQLA and using the bulk of it is on Ethereum today.
And so basically, when you consider that, like that to me, this 90 plus percent, and again, we're still in the first out of the first inning 10 years later, but the 90% there is very reminiscent to me of the gravity law dynamics that Google has, where 90% of searches happen on Google and less than 1% happens on Bing, less than 1% happens on Yahoo, less than 1% happens on Ask Jeeves, and we're further continuing kind of those parallel dynamics.
Understood. And we'll come back to that too. There's the big battle for internet capital markets that's developing, which I'm keenly interested in. And I think tokenization, we're still early days. There's a lot more to happen here also. Let's get back to your Diamond Hands story. What did that turn like emotionally?
Yeah.
There must have been times you're like, oh, I feel like a hero. Oh, God, I can't believe, why don't I not take some chips off the table?
Yeah, there were definitely times they take the chips off the table, but there were definitely, what I've learned was the best thing to do is live below your means.
You're on the ramen noodle diet.
I was on the ramen noodle diet for a long time. And frankly, I also had an understanding of the concept of H2LA. I had the understanding of the metrics of developer usage. And I couldn't exit the position because I thought every huge upswing and drawdown was going to be a smaller blip on a 20-year curve.
This thing went from $1,000 plus to $80 in a bear market. What were you feeling in your gut at $80? Were you just saying, hey, I need to sell, get some, I'm up 80X, just take
it? No, not at that point. No, no, at 80, I wanted to buy more. I just didn't have
any. So I'm trying to get the psychology of Diamond Handy. So at $80, you're like, more, I want more. Okay, got it. And so tell us about like your concentration of this asset over time. And you must have had advisors and wealth advisors saying, Andrew, it's about to diversify.
And listen to them. And here we are, which is fine. I've since listened to a few advisors a little bit, but the more the less you diversify. And there's a lot I don't know. I definitely think that this technology is the next generation of the database and the internet. I've found it to be something worthy of my professional time. I found it to be fascinating. And I just think that kind of understanding the technological arc and the use case arc, and basically the fact that it's $250 billion of HQLA and how many trillions of dollars of HQLA is there on Earth. It's just, if we're still talking 1%, these are still smaller blips on a larger scale.
Fair enough. So let's talk about where we are with digital assets and tokenization. The Genius Act creates a legal framework for stablecoin transfer. They're issued by non-banks who are not permitted to offer yield. Banks can offer tokenized deposits. These are now in the legal fold. They're playing an important role. It's the first tokenized assets to achieve strong product market fit. Obviously, the players like Tether out there is acknowledging US coin, their Circle, Paxos has one. There's dozens and dozens that are proliferating now. Where do you see tokenization evolving from here, especially as it relates between Ethereum and Solana?
Sure.
There's Galaxy tokenized on chain on Solana. Go ahead. Yeah.
So first and foremost, with respect to the Genius Act passage, it's important to like give the context of how often this type of legislation gets passed. Like from the last type of kind of like monumental asset was like the 1940s Act. It's the 1940s, literally 2 months ago, something as big as the 1940s Act just passed.
100%.
And I think that's like super duper.
Appreciate consequences.
Yeah. And so that basically gave the green light, not only for the banks to play, the fintechs to play, but Walmart to play. There should be a digital token that represents dollars so they can solve that problem, which is basically like the real-time gross settlement across time zones and jurisdictions. You have a company like ExxonMobil that's in 300 different jurisdictions that have to make payroll every 2 weeks. And basically they can actually now optimize their payroll and basically send value much more easily without kind of FX spreads. Basically all of that just passed 50 days ago.
It's wild. Like the US government, Congress has said individuals or entities can send programmable money, e.g. a stable coin backed by treasuries, to one another without KYC or AML, it's not intermediated by a bank, can live on chain. It can go across borders and permissionlessly. This is wild stuff.
And furthermore, we just take it for granted using banks now. And basically, simply put, with banks, we deposit the money, Bank of America issued treasuries, and they can live on that 4% yield that we never avail ourselves to. And let's call it the opening act of Circle. You didn't get any of the upside of that. You know, what the examples I give is now what I'm starting to see when I pop up to purchase an item, I can buy the item for $103 with my Amex or my Google Play or my Apple Pay. And you could buy the same item for $100. So you're disintermediating the payment processors. And basically what this technology does is it gives a price discovery mechanism for the value of intermediation. But now furthermore, like second generations of this, that's, let's call it Circle's USD first out the gate. Now talk about like other stable coins, like Paxos, for example, they share some of the treasury yield with the owner. So basically you can have some of these stable coins that now earn an embedded yield to them. And that's the magic. So if there's a 4% treasury, you can see a world where your stable coin, that your $100 worth of stable coins may be earning 2% in addition to you being able to use it without having to pay the payment processor.
Right. And you're actually going bankless. And instead of having an institution like a bank custody your assets, your custody is performed by encryption, by cryptography. Banks are millennia old business models, or high quality business model. They've stood the test of millennia. And now for the first time, we have cryptography meeting the internet, meeting software that can make commitments, to use Chris Dixon's language, now with the backing of US Congress, enable people to move money and accept money as a merchant. Take a look at Visa stock, by the way. So the S&P is essentially at all-time highs. Visa, June 2nd, just around when the Genius Act was passed, down to the 200-day moving average. Although I think Visa will be fine the next few years. All to say is that the narrative risk is being priced into businesses like Visa and others that represent the old guard of accepting and moving money.
And to that point, the largest beneficiary of Genius is Ethereum.
Why is
that? Because the majority of stablecoins settle on Ethereum. So basically, they're in a hegemonic position because the largest amount of HQLA and stablecoins, or that includes stablecoins, are settling on Ethereum. And now, furthermore, the next one that we're going to see it probably in November, which is Clarity, is market structure. Yeah. So basically, Genius was stablecoin. Clarity is market structure. So let's call it tokenizing everything else.
Yeah.
And again, if from my vantage, because you've got this hegemonic position where this one blockchain has multiple clients, has geographic diversity, has the most validators, has these standards, has the most amount of HQLA on it, the beneficiary of that, in my opinion, is going to be Ethereum.
And by multiple clients, you mean like MetaMask, Coinbase Wallet?
No, by client, there's a Java implementation, a Go implementation, a .NET implementation. Yeah, we could say that at the application layer as well. But basically, that is the difference of being able to have something that has 100% uptime from inception to something that can break.
Look, I agree. The Ethereum is indexed to this. It goes back to my thesis. I wish I could find some points of disagreement with you here, but I agree. Yeah. There's a lot of people talking about the 4-year cycle around Bitcoin. I don't think it's going to apply like an asset like Ethereum because of the wave of tokenization that's going to happen. Right? There's that entrepreneurs have to disintermediate now, banks and issuers of assets. And those asset issuers want to go on chain to find their counterparts, right? Like KKR is issuing on chain, Apollo is going on chain. Now, it's going to take time for that to develop. And go ahead.
Nothing to add there.
Okay. So how do you think about just how tokenization evolves from here with the Clarity Act? So the Genius Act uses a framework for money on chain, money movement on chain. You mentioned the Clarity Act. What should we expect from that? And is that going to be passed this year? Do you see?
I think it will get passed this year. I think it will be another groundbreaking, again, these two acts, these types of legislation acts, the last material one was in 1940. And if we get these two, this is a huge, it's so notable how infrequent these things occur. And to that, basically, it permits risk-averse institutions to engage in this technology. And you've already seen what's gone on in the IPO market in this administration of, let's call it just the public blockchain companies coming to market. And then what we're going to see is the tokenization of all assets. I think securities, commodities.
And no, I agree. I was at the RWA conference last week there, and our last weekend's Illuminate newsletter called Tokenization is Discontent. If you tokenize assets on chain, let's say a private credit fund, it's now available as a source of liquidity. You can margin against it. Cross margining is unlocked. And so for those reasons, those assets will go on chain. That's it.
And what I'd say is we've seen this kind of adverse effect where maybe some assets that couldn't get liquidity otherwise get tokenized. You're not going to create liquidity for something that there's no bid anyways. But I think there's a lot of things like Anthropic stock or the private equities that they don't have market access. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Market access, I think, is a great use case. And also, like, securitization itself belongs on chain. If you think about what happened in the 2008 crisis, the lack of loan level transparency, which still exists today, like my prior startup, Pure IQ, solved that for privately issued ABS. It was an analog to going into the loans. All of that should be on chain. Everyone should have transparency into the collateral and the payments that underpin these bonds. So it's a good public policy. So what else?
And what I'd say is what the capital markets is used to right now is a quarterly look back, like from a regulatory compliant perspective.
Yeah.
And with this, the regulatory body should be a node on the environment that has real-time access to real-time assets. And basically, you should be able to see, and basically programmability, you should be able to embed in the assets the rules. So you're almost like regulators could be smart contract approvers, if you will. And I think that may be a little bit naive or idealistic of me, because there's just a delta of the people that are smart enough to actually build this stuff don't necessarily want to be sitting at a regulatory body. So I just think that, but I think that's where the puck will be trending towards.
Yeah, this is why programmers get to be bankers now. I hope they understand credit risk underwriting, but yeah, they get to be bank now. They get good money. On Ethereum machine, just circling back to that, we'll work to your closing thoughts. There's like no warrants component, or you can just buy Ethereum QTIP. How do you think about the warrants component? So I own the ETHM warrants, by the way. I have a view that in a couple of years, this will be up. And how do you think about that underwrite and the warrants versus just spot exposures?
I think that the warrants are probably a better way to express. I probably should say—
You're obviously biased and you're—
Yeah, this isn't investment advice. But I think that one can easily underwrite how much ether is in the vehicle. Where does one see the price of ether? How does one conceptualize the yield generated versus the ETF, knowing that the ETFs will have to deal with 24-hour redemptions? And I think that the warrants are probably a simpler way to express one's view, or probably a more direct way to express one's view.
Got it. And do you see any catalysts coming up that people should be aware of, like certain events?
So the big one is the blessing of the S4. So basically, this is a machine that's in the barn waiting to be let out, right? And basically, as soon as this machine is a fully fledged public vehicle through the blessing of the business combination agreement. So an S1 is an IPO, an S4 is a merger. And so the S4 is the document that one has to file with the SEC that merges a special purpose acquisition company and a de novo entity. That's what—
Why does that unlock value? ETHM is trading right now in the market. Why is value unlocked? Why does that business become released?
Because then all of the committed capital now has the shares issued for it. And then it is fully trading with, I would just call it the total quantity of assets under management.
And so shares outstanding will go up, but also the balance sheet of ETHM will go up by the amount of Ethereum that's contributed.
Correct.
So that's
and then the main is then now we'll be able to issue credit and or equity instruments and basically issue convertible bonds, preferred shares, etc. So basically we'll be able to do everything on chain and then really issue out the instruments that this thing was solely built for. We believe that we've done the right thing by going without the contingent liabilities, going for the big four audit, so that basically Wall Street, who we're good at educating, can work with us to create financial instruments to basically drive our North Star, which is increasing our Ether concentration per share.
Right. Grow Ether per share over time. And that's the mission and mantra of essentially all of these DATs. That is the value prop of a DAT versus saying owning an ETF. ETF is solid for dollar exposure. Here, there are operations the DAT can perform to generate greater Ethereum per share. How do you see the DAT cycle playing out where we are now? We had MSTR for a few years, then you saw a proliferation of DATs over the last few months. I think volume DATs has been exhausting. I think personally, we're on the later end of that. And we talked about some of the announcements we see in the DAT land with expensing of private jets and all some stuff. So where do you see DR in that? How does this unfold? Do you think we'll see DATs trade?
So I think we'll see DATs trade below NAB. I think we'll see a consolidation. I think we'll see the difference between the wheat and the chaff of basically, are there operating personnel that can actually drive creative shareholder Ether concentration per share as an example. And I think that it's also, there's like critical masses, right? Like I think that the asset has to trade, Ether trades $40, $50 billion a day, right? So there are arbitragers that could essentially, if something traded below NAV on Ether, someone could short Ether and then long the DAT. And there are different ways to play that kind of arbitrage game. But if you are the 50th, 100th asset on CoinMarketCap, it's a much less liquid market. And so I would say I actually am very bearish on most DATs because I just don't think there's enough liquidity. I also think that the index DATs, I've done, let's call it 300 investor calls. And I think real institutional investors understand these notions of contingent liabilities. Real institutional investors understand the silly games similar to what we discussed today, where we headline that something sold at a premium, but we have in fine print that there were extra warrants given away. But retail doesn't get that yet. I think you'll see some DAT get sued. I think you'll see some DAT implode. There was a merger today of two because the one that had Bitcoin that was trading under NAV. So you're going to see consolidation. I also think the notion of these index DATs don't make sense. One that's 27% Ether or a DAT that owns, let's call it 20% Ether, 20% Bitcoin, 20% XRP. So basically, because, for two reasons. One, institutional investors want to determine their own exposure. They may say, I want 70% Ether or 10% Bitcoin or vice versa. They don't think that you're going to be the picker of it. And furthermore, you don't issue a convert on that, right? It's because how do you think that through?
Yeah, I agree. That's CDO squares. It doesn't make any sense. It's a sign of the nuttiness in the market. So I spoke with a large investor behind these DATs. And what he told me is this, he had this sweet spot. I asked him, hey, look, what happens when these DATs trade below M to NAV? And here's what his response was. I found very surprising. He said, what a DAT would do then is they would sell spot. So in other words, you have a DAT holding Ethereum or holding Bitcoin.
Buy shares.
And then buy shares to close the gap. Do you think we'll see that happen?
We've seen it. SBET has done it already.
So that would create sell pressure on the spot asset that nominally the DAT is supposed to represent accumulating Ethereum per share over time. Does that affect the overall story or is it just rational behavior?
I think it's so early. that these things need, let's call it a year or 2 years. And then basically what one needs to really understand is there's, let's call it the concentration per share and then the generation per share. So there's what is the team doing to actually generate on a monthly basis? And I think that like there's kind of two metrics. The concentration per share gets skewed by if someone came out the gate really hot when it was hot, let's call it 2-3 months ago, they may have increased their concentration per share then, but now is flatlined. And when you get a, like a monthly tear sheet from a hedge fund, you have to see your monthly performance. And so basically you're going to see, and what we're going to help educate the market is what is that monthly performance and the monthly ongoing generation. And I think that's
good. Right, through your operating activity, like one lever is the operating activities. Right, how efficiently are you at generating ether per share? And you have that through the Dharma capability, right? Then, but the second is like, what is the MNAV? If you have a higher MNAV, then you can acquire more spot. Now, if something trades below MNAV, they lose that lever,
right?
They can sell their holdings and buy back their shares and attempt to
close. Or go private.
Right, or do a private to release it, which then what was the point of this whole exercise in the financial markets? Then they can get back to par value if they sell spot, buy back their shares. It's not clear how they get above par value. If you're above par value, you're in a different class of debt. Mm-hmm. As you get below par value, and like MicroStrategy has been coming under pressure, they're still above par value now. But if you go below, I wonder what that means in terms
of... Well, and I don't think it's as static, right? I think it could be like public sentiment. Like I wouldn't be surprised if rates go down, everyone gets a bump in their MNAV. So if there's other considerations of things are going to fluctuate, but I think the variable that let's call it generation and MNAV, I kind of call it on like on-chain and off-chain. There's what can I do to generate yield? And then what type of financial instruments make sense considering market dynamics? If something's trading at a 4 MNAV or 3 MNAV, 2 MNAV, maybe you should be selling at ATM.
Yeah,
makes sense. If something's... And then I also think that one has to understand like the converts are talking about, let's call it time duration, where you probably have to layer something that's 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. And then the preferreds, they're perpetual, but there is a coupon. And how are you satisfying that coupon? Good thing with Ether versus Bitcoin. Therein goes versus Bitcoin, where there's back to our initial conversation where there's no yield generation. Right. This is how you can satisfy a coupon using Ether yield generating strategies. And it goes down to management and execution. These things are not created equal. And then like also some people are going to realize a year from now, they were screwed out the gate because they started with the wrong structure. And I think that the shell companies are a mess.
Yeah. So you have two kinds of operations, like on-chain generation, lever one, lever two, off-chain capital markets activity, building an ecosystem around the debt, be very thoughtful about floating versus fixed rate, callable versus not callable, recourse versus non-recourse.
And splaying them, right? So that risk management metrics and what are the historic drawdowns and all of that.
And then the third lever is the MNAV. It's not a lever per se, but it matters. The lever that drives that metric, though, is the attention economy. It's cutting through the noise, right? Obviously, Michael Saylor did this with MicroStrategy. That is the value Tom Lee brought to Bitminer. But the lever here then would be to drive that premium. It's social media, it's make it go meme, the attention. So what are the levers?
And I would say execution, right? All the attention in the world can work against you if one is doing dilutive activities versus accretive activities.
Right.
And if one is doing accretive activities and executing properly and structuring things properly, we expect the cream to rise to the top. And then to your point, that's why we're on these Zooms right now. And that's, we're spending a bunch of time in a multimedia strategy.
Makes sense. I guess one last question from here. I always enjoy talking to Andrew. We can go on for hours. It's always a real treat and a real pleasure. How do you think about your personal liquidity, right? You've now contributed in kind of massive piece. You're committed. where do you get your liquidity, if and when and how? Because that's part of this whole story, right? You've personally identified a material part of your balance sheet to this asset.
I have enough elsewhere to, yeah, I'm good.
That's smart. That's a good answer. Good. So you're not, you don't need to hit the bid if something goes south and you've proven through cycles that you got the diamond hand. Okay.
Sometimes you got to put your money where your mouth is.
Fair enough. Any concluding thoughts, Andrew?
Keep enjoying yourself.
Thank you.
You never work a day in your life.
That's great. Work and play. If you make that go hand in hand, nothing can stop you. I agree. Thank you, Mr. Andrew Crean. Until next time, keep up the wonderful work and chat with you again.
You're welcome. Cheers.
Cheers. Thank you for listening in on the episode. Remember, in the world of investing, the road less traveled often leads to the greatest rewards. I'm Ram Ahluwalia, your host and chief investment officer at Lumita Wealth, where we specialize in the craft of alternative investments. Invest wisely, stay ahead of the curve, and stay non-consensus.